HBPodcraft.com.
West of Arkham, the hills rise wild, and there are valleys with deep woods that no axe has ever cut. There are dark, narrow glens where the trees slope fantastically, and where thin brooklets trickle without ever having caught the glint of sunlight. On the gentler slopes, there are farms, ancient and rocky, with squat, moss-coated cottages brooding eternally over old New England secrets in the lee of great ledges. But these are all vacant now, the wide chimneys crumbling and the shingled sides bulging perilously beneath low gambrel roofs. The old folk have gone away, and foreigners do not like to live there. French Canadians have tried it, Italians have tried it, and the Poles have come and departed. It is not because of anything that can be seen or heard or handled, but because of something that is imagined. The place is not good for the imagination, and does not bring restful dreams at night. It must be this which keeps the foreigners away, for old Amy Pierce has never told them of anything he recalls from the strange days. Amy, whose head has been a little queer for years, is the only one who still remains or whoever talks of the strange days. And he dares to do this because his house is so near the open fields and the traveled roads around Arkham.
I'm rolling.
Rolling. Ba-ba-ba-ba. That reading was a... Sorry,
go ahead.
That's right.
That reading was a flash from the past.
It was a plosive from the past, a pre-pop screen performance, yet one that still draws you in.
Andrew Lehman read for the story back in November of 2010, and that was him once again.
Yeah, we probably could have re-recorded it, but I like that lo-fi sound. Makes me want to go plosive up all our later, better sounding stuff. Have that authentic feel to it.
I don't want to do that.
But, I just don't want to put in the work, but I should.
Yeah, exactly. And I love the way our show sounds now. But since folks have asked for revisiting the old episodes, this is a thing that's been going on for a long, long time. Guess what? You're getting it. We are going back to the past to dredge up from the well the color out of space.
Oh, I see what you did there. Yeah. Folks have wanted us to revisit some of Lovecraft stuff for a while, as you say, and we're nearing our 500th episode, so it just seemed like the stars were right.
We discussed how to go about this and decided that just redoing a story was redundant. So we went back, listened to our old episodes, and I honestly think we nailed it back then.
Yeah.
And I agree with my old self on my thoughts about this story, but it was fun to listen to and get these little snippets of the people that we were then.
Yeah, it was incredibly strange to listen to because it was all brand new content to me in so many ways, but on certain moments I would actually remember making the edit.
Oh, wow.
Because if it was something that was difficult in the episode or something I had to cut around, I would suddenly flash back to the job I was slacking off at and doing this instead. But that was a weird experience. Very strange.
In case you forgot what the story was about, here's a short synopsis. Our narrator, an unnamed surveyor from Boston, is telling us about this place called the Blasted Heath. My old speed metal band. He found a guy called Ami Pierce who tells him about the Gardner family. Ami tells him that a meteorite hit in 1882 on the Gardner farm.
The meteor shrinks but doesn't cool, and some scientists come and check it out. The thing stinks really bad and leaves behind some color that can't be described. The meteor is hit by lightning 6 times and then is gone. The scientist's samples also disappear.
So the Gardner family has this amazing harvest with all this huge veg and fruit, but guess what? It tastes terrible. Nam, the father, tries to tell people the meteor has contaminated the ground. Soon animals and plants start mutating. The plants glow slightly in the dark. Gardner's wife loses her mind and she's locked in the attic. Soon the whole family begins isolating themselves of particular relevance right now.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. Ami is the only guy that's visiting the farm and he sees the horror unfolding. Their last son disappears. Ami has to put the wife out of her misery because she's turning into an ash person. Nam is also just a gray, ashy person by the end who doesn't seem in his right mind, suffering from some kind of dementia. He dies and turns to dust.
Ami returns later with a posse and they find skeletons in the well of two of the Gardner boys and a bunch of animals. Out of the well shoots a bunch of crazy colored light and it goes right up into space. Ami notices that some of the colors seems like it was trying to leave with the rest of it, but then kind of retreated back into the ground. So the whole area is now just gray dust and the neighbors move away. At the end, we get this.
What it is, only God knows. In terms of matter, I suppose the thing Ami described would be called a gas, but this gas obeyed laws that are not of our cosmos. This was no fruit of such worlds and suns as shine on the telescopes and photographic plates of our observatories. This was no breath from the skies whose motions and dimensions our astronomers measure or deem too vast to measure. It was just a color out of space, a frightful messenger from unformed realms of infinity beyond all nature as we know it, from realms whose mere existence stuns the brain and numbs us with the black extracosmic gulfs it throws open before our frenzied eyes.
And that's the end of our revisit of The Color Out of Space. We're all done. Hey, let's talk about something that I never really do, re-listening to these old podcasts in which we covered this story.
Oh, boy. The first thing I noticed was the audio is not great.
Yep, right away. I thought, oh, man, I don't even know if I can get through this, but I have to admit, I stopped caring after a minute or two.
It did not bother me at all.
I just faded into it, and it didn't bother me anymore.
The content is so good.
Well, it's consistently bad is the thing. So
exactly,
there's not
yes.
new badnesses to surprise you later. So once you settle into it, it's fine.
I was surprised to hear Paul McLean on the two episodes of Color Out of Space. I totally forgot that he was our guest host on that episode.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I moved to Yorkshire, and he was kind of helping me out with stuff as I was transitioning to living in England. And I became very close friends with him. And so it made sense to kind of do a crossover episode.
Right.
His audio sounds much better than ours.
Of course.
And he has the right setup. And it took me a while to get up to speed to where he is. But I think now we sound pretty good.
Yeah, Paul was great. And we really didn't bring him in enough. It was, you know, I was happy to hear him. Oh, yeah, he guessed it. That's great. And then I kept forgetting, even while I was listening, that he was there until he'd chime in on something. So hopefully our hosting skills have improved since then.
I think they have.
Well, I think they've improved just by virtue of the fact that we realized, oh, if the guest does all the talking, we can be lazy. So the proper incentive presented itself along the way.
Another fun tidbit about this episode seems to be it was the first time that we offered t-shirts from Cafe Press, which have been around for so long. I remember seeing that fellow in that issue of The Guardian, this guy who had a t-shirt of ours from this Cafe Press thing.
Yeah.
I was thinking when I saw that guy in The Guardian just wearing a t-shirt, just some dude, I was like, we made it, man. We're somebody's.
Totally. Somebody's who never really got their merch sorted out past Cafe Press, though.
No.
Luckily, Graham Pilling at Army of Cats Design has just made an amazing 10th anniversary poster for us, as well as some t-shirts and tote bags. And that is something you can pre-order now. I'm going to cut in some information on it here, and you probably won't be able to tell it all. cut it in because my editing skills have improved vastly.
Like I was saying, there's links in the show notes. You can go now to get a limited edition screen printed anniversary poster and some t-shirts and totes. Now, anyway, back to what I was talking about.
See that?
Wow.
Yeah, seamless.
That was amazing.
So those were the details on how you can get that stuff. But yeah, it was funny to hear about Cafe Press. It was also funny to hear notes from Dakotas. You were announcing your show with Paul. Do you guys do that anymore?
No, we haven't done that in a long time. We went from that to Cthulhu Breakfast Club, and then that was it. That just stopped when the cafe that we used to do it at closed down. So not doing a show with Paul right now.
Yeah.
So sad. Something that hasn't been brought up on the show enough, which was brought up on this episode, was Hatebeak.
Right.
Do you remember the speed metal band that has
course.
A gray parrot as its lead singer?
Yes.
They got a lot of love in this episode, and that brought me joy.
Yeah, I forgot that we'd mentioned. I knew that we'd mentioned them because I remember after that episode, a member of Hatebeak actually reached out. Remember and said,
hey, man,
thanks for the mention. I listened to the show. You guys are great. And then we emailed back and forth. There was some mutual admiration there. So that, again, made me feel like, man, if Hatebeak's writing me, I really...
Yeah, you're
We've
somebody.
Really made it. Update on Hatebeak. They released the album Number of the Beak on June 26, 2015 through Reptilian Records. And Hatebeak made its second record with Caninus, which is a band whose lead singers are two dogs. So the beak is still out there, man.
Awesome.
On the topic of when we're recording this, sometimes we record... I'd say most of the time we record the very week we release the show, or at least within a week of releasing the show.
Yeah.
But lately we've been recording a bit ahead for a number of reasons. And even though you're hearing this in May, it is still March on this end, the end of March. We're all under quarantine in both of our respective countries, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Although here I'll probably seamlessly edit in some comment to make this show all timely.
Wow. Is it already May 7th today?
Oh,
wow.
Seamless,
Chad.
Yeah.
That fact was very pertinent to what's happening right now.
I'd say it is. Anyway, I've still been trying to get long walks in, which we can still do right now as long as we're socially distancing. And I decided to listen to these two episodes of The Color Out of Space on a 5-mile walk through the dead ghost town of Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
It was a very eerie experience. And there were some funny bits in the shows, but mostly it was just incredibly sad. And the environment was really lending itself to that. And of course, at the end of the second episode, I'm talking about pandemics and viral infections, societies being destroyed. I got home, and I'd been putting off seeing the movie, which we'll get to in a minute, until we were going to record the episode. I wanted it to be fresh in my mind, so I listened to the episodes, got home, threw that baby on, and watched it.
Geez.
And I got to tell you, by the end of the day, I was depressed.
Yeah.
I've been coping fairly well with the pandemic, just really focusing on projects, but that one was a really bad day, so thanks, Lovecraft. And then the next day, when we were initially supposed to record this, we got the bad news about our friend Stuart Gordon.
Yeah, Stuart passed away. He had health problems for a while, so it wasn't COVID-related, I believe, at this point.
Yeah, I don't think so.
He was such a nice guy. We were trying to get a project made with him back when I lived in L.A. It was called Solitude. And he's just the nicest, most supportive guy around. Really just, he's been around the block, but he wasn't one of those guys that was jaded by it. He was just free to offer advice, and he's helpful and understanding. And the last time I saw him was at Necronomicon in 2013, because I was living in the UK, so I wasn't back there. I hadn't talked to him since I moved away. It'd probably been four or five years since I actually had a conversation. And when I saw him, he like warmly greeted me in a way that just, I don't know. It's one of those things where, because he's a busy guy, he's a famous person, he knows lots of people. But when I saw him again, it was like he was so happy to see me, and it made me feel so good. And he's just that, he's just that kind of guy.
I introduced myself to him probably the first 20 times. I mean, I was literally working on a script with him, and I'd still be like, hey, I'm Chad, you know, because I just assumed he didn't know who I was.
Yes.
Yeah. Until finally one day he goes, yeah, I know.
Yeah, Chad, I know who you are.
And he was, yeah, exactly. I learned so much from him, and he was such a nice, kind guy. And I have a really great memory of being at the Lovecraft Film Festival with him here in San Pedro. It was the first one they did here, I think, in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. We were backstage. There was some kind of burlesque act going on or something. And one of the girls, she was all gothed out, looking very good. And she said, who is that guy? I said, oh, that's Stuart Gordon, the famous film director. She didn't really know who he was, but she goes, oh, but he's famous, right? And I said, yeah, I mean, among a certain group of people, he's definitely very famous. And she goes, I thought so, because he is hot. He is smoking hot. Like, she goes, that older man vibe, and then he's just got this energy. I don't know.
Yeah.
I was like, wow. Because I guess I, you know, he's a good looking guy, but I never really thought of him in those terms. So I came backstage and I go, Stuart, that girl over there's really crushing on you. And he got so blushed. It was like we were teenagers.
Aww.
He said, no, she's not. I'm not kidding. Unsolicited.
Yeah.
Was talking you up. And he just kind of got real nervous and shy, and it was very cute.
Aww.
So I was very upset to hear about his passing.
We were going to record, and it was just, we were both feeling so bad.
I have friends that I never would have had if he hadn't introduced me to him, and I was talking with those folks, and it was a sad day. So we call off the show and took a day or two, but all of this is just to say that on a revisit to The Color Out of Space, it's still really depressing.
Yeah. Speaking of depressing, there's also something I want to bring up that I said on the show that seems insensitive now. It's a point that I was confused about the gender of one of the Gardner kids. I thought one was a girl. And they're all
boys.
Because
of the name, right?
Yeah. And I made a very lame joke about how he thinks he's a girl, but he's just actually a man. And I know that I meant no ill will at the time, but hearing it now, I did feel embarrassed.
Hmm.
And that's because over these last few years, I've made some new friends that are transgender, others that are non-binary, and my understanding of the lives of folks going through this is a lot more based in reality. So now I feel if you identify as a woman, you're a woman. I'll use your preferred pronouns, whatever you like. I'm happy to. If it can make a person feel more comfortable in their own skin by me using her, him, they, I enthusiastically will do so.
Sure.
Like, great. Whatever I can do to make you feel better. Hearing myself make that joke really showed me how much my views have changed just over this short period of time.
Oh, of course. I mean, if I even hear jokes I made a few years ago, I think, why did I say that? But if I could introduce some nuance, I mean, I know what you're talking about, and it kind of rang weird on my ear too. I think you could have offended with that comment, and you would probably say it more make the joke more artfully. Now, I would say that I think you were kind of making fun of somebody who would say that. But the way you did it, it was like you were being that kind of person who would say something like that, and in a way sort of making fun of the kind of person who would say it.
Yes.
I understood that that wasn't how you really felt. Like,
no.
You weren't calling the kid a sissy.
No.
So I don't think it was all that bad, but I do think it is interesting to note, oh, I would never make that joke now, or I would do it in a different way.
Yeah, and I've grown over this period of time, and
right.
I'm hoping I'm continuing to grow as I get older and be able to adapt with the times and learn.
Be careful what you wish for, because as we learned on our bonus episode last month, sometimes you keep growing taller and taller, and there's, you know, that can have its own set of problems.
Just don't make a comment on it. I'll be all right.
Okay.
One of the Lovecraftian themes that really sticks out in this story is that learning or exploring is not always a good thing. Mm. So when they're talking about poking the meteor, we have to be careful exploring because we might uncover something we don't want to find, something that will harm us or even destroy us. And it's a sobering thought and an aspect that doesn't get addressed that much in these stories. And that's why I think people are still honestly talking about Lovecraft after all these years.
Definitely. I have to say your empathy really shines through in those episodes, because a lot of your content, especially as the story goes along, is just, oh God, it's so horrible. But it is the voice of the reader as they're going through the story, and it does keep you interested. And it's probably something I didn't notice at the time.
I mean, I think that's a testament to the writing as well, is that I felt the things that were going on and how terrible they were. Where you could watch some terrible movie and they've got people's like heads blown off and stuff, and you're like, whatever, because it's not real. There's not like these cheesy action movies are like when Schwarzenegger throws a buzzsaw into some guy's head.
Yeah.
It's not based in any truism. It's just ridiculousness. Whereas the things that happen in the story feel real.
No, I'm just laughing because it's like there's somebody listening right now who's like, oh yeah, I guess I better stop putting The Color Out of Space and Commando in the same category. I'm glad that these have been contrasted for me effectively.
But you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Yeah, you care about what's happening to these people, for
yes,
sure.
And that's what I'm trying to say.
It hurts you on a personal level when you just see them get pummeled.
And also, there's a comment where you make, or I say something, I mention quoting Robert M. Price, and you're like, oh, who's that? You know, like, you didn't know who Robert Price was at that point.
I did. I was doing my impression of everybody after that Necronomicon speech. Who's Robert Price?
I think it's a pretty good show, and I don't really have much else to say about it.
Yeah, me neither. Mostly, I kind of just wanted more. I remember that we had done a rap about The Color Out of Space that kind of told the story of what happened, but in kind of a hip urban way, and we decided to cut it for time. You remember that? Or is that... It was called Word to Your Color. It was very cutting edge hip hop. It was like, my name is Amy and I'm here to say that color isn't green and it isn't gray. What?
Yeah.
And then you beatboxed.
Oh, right. Yeah, now I remember it.
Yeah, now you remember. You beatboxed. Yeah. Anyway,
I wish we'd
left it in because that could have provided some levity maybe, but it's lost the time. That hard drive actually that had that song on it just burst into fire one night. I don't know what happened. And it had that rap we did about the Night Ocean on it, too. So, lost the time. We were really spitting fire on that Night Ocean.
Yeah,
chart.
That was really good. I'm afraid that thing probably burst into flames because the tracks were too hot.
Yeah. They never warn you about that with these hard drives. Don't get a magnet by it. Don't spit fire that hard on a Night Ocean rap. It should be right there in the... But yeah, I don't think we exhausted all there is to say about this story on those episodes, but I'm afraid I don't have any new insights.
No.
All I really have is appreciation. It's clearly still a relevant story, you know, given what's going on. And my perceptions of it do change as I age and as the world changes around me. When we did the story in 2010, when I was 35, I definitely was thinking about death. I've lost a lot of friends to cancer, family members to various illnesses, and had already at that point. And this story makes me think, as it did then, of that last leg when you're trying different things to save somebody and nothing works and the lows get lower and then it's over.
Yeah.
Reading it again at 45, I still feel young, but it's a closer experience to, well, this reminds me less of experiencing the deaths of others and gives me more anxiety for the time when those things tumble for me personally, when it's all trough and there are no more peaks for myself or close family members. But most of all, I was reminded that Lovecraft is a great writer in this story. You know, we do a lot of gentle ribbing of the man in our other episodes, but this was a pretty solid thwack back, I thought, because other than the toilet toilety bowl thing that we made fun of. It really is a masterwork, and I appreciate it all the more so many years later because we've covered all these other authors, most of whom are enormously talented in their own right, but nobody has the secret sauce that HBL has. You know, it's just a unique interpretation of influences that's heightened by his flaws, and there's really still nothing like it. So I remembered that.
This story inspired a lot of movies. For one, Die Monster Die.
Right, which we covered in a bonus episode.
Also The Curse and Die Farb, and the newest, the Richard Stanley movie, The Color Out of Space, starring Nicolas Cage.
Yes, let's talk about that.
Richard Stanley did this post-apocalyptic movie back in 1990 called Hardware. And I think the guys from Fields of the Nephilim are in it because he also directed some of their videos as well. He was going to be the director of the adaptation of The Island of Dr. Moreau that had Marlon Brando in it, but that didn't work out so well. There's a whole documentary about it called Lost Souls. It's on Netflix, Amazon Prime. Have you seen it?
I don't know. It merits rewatching because if I can't remember, then it would probably be all new to me again. But
It's
I've
really
heard things
good
about that production and how bad it was.
It talks about the craziness that was that movie and mostly just the problems they had with the production, but also Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer were total jerks and divas. A 6-week shooting schedule became 6 months.
Wow.
He got kicked off the movie before it even started, and then he went off and lived in the woods by himself. Like, man, it's a crazy story. I want to spoil things, but no, watch the documentary.
I'll check it out.
It does good stuff where things happen where you're like, what? Like, that happened? Like, you think, okay, now I know where they're at, but then it does good turns, and then crazy things happen. It's really good. This guy, Richard Stanley's a little, from the documentary, he's a little nutty of a dude, but he was really into H.P. Lovecraft. Now, without talking any spoilers yet about this movie, I think generally this Color Out of Space movie is a good adaptation. A Rotten Tomato review of it here, I think, sums it up pretty well. It says, a welcome return of director Richard Stanley, Color Out of Space mixes tart B-movie pulp with visually alluring Lovecraftian horror and a dash of gonzo Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary. That nails it. It is a very beautiful movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Gorgeous it is to watch.
So now we are going to go into specifics of the film. If you do not want to hear about the specifics of the movie, skip to the end of the show. Okay?
Yeah.
It stars Nicolas Cage as Nathan Gardner, a well-off city guy who's moved into the family farm after his wife Teresa's battle with cancer.
Yeah, I guess he had a bad relationship with his father who's left this farm behind and he's revamped it. What did you think about bringing cancer into it, the subplot in which the wife didn't feel like a woman anymore?
I thought that was interesting, and it also makes it more sad because they lived through a thing and then this all happened. So I thought it really added more weight to it.
You did.
Honestly. And I know Richard Stanley's mom had cancer and died. And his mom was the one that read him Lovecraft when he was young. So I think that probably ties
in.
So
that
well
might have been part of the connection. No, I thought it was an interesting comment that, when we met the daughter, that she was doing this cult ritual, which we'll get to in a second. But it was to cure her mother's cancer. Because even though I think she'd had the mastectomy, she was still sick when we
she's still working. Yeah, they're a little ambiguous about what her health condition is at that point. But they were really good about not doing too much exposition, I thought.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought that you just found the family in that place. But I thought that it did reinforce the cosmic worldview in a way that she had done that ritual and then everybody got sick. There's nothing you can do. The cosmos doesn't care. In fact, in response to something silly like that, you get a meteor that basically gives everybody cancer. You know, so I thought it reinforced the theme as well.
So they have 3 kids. Lavinia is their teenage daughter, and Benny, the teenage stoner son, and Jack, he's a little kid with thick glasses that reminded me of my son, because they're about the same age.
And yeah, that's the same kid that's in The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix, which I thought that must be so strange because he's probably not allowed to watch any of the stuff he's in. So that's going to be very dislocating when he's a teenager, you know, like when you see an old photo of yourself you've never seen before and you think, what was going on? What was I doing? You know, I had a purple shirt. I don't remember that shirt. It'll be like that. I was in a movie with Nicolas Cage. I remember this. Why is he yelling at me?
So as you say, Lavinia is outperforming a Wiccan ritual to help her mother's healing when this guy, Ward, he is a hydrologist surveyor, so like the original story, who's there to check out the area for a hydroelectric dam that they're building.
He's wearing a Miskatonic University t-shirt. Was that a prop from the HPLHS?
Oh, I don't think so. Maybe it was.
I couldn't. I was like, wait a minute. I hope they didn't make that, because there's a bevy of supplies right now at hplhs.org. There was a bit of a B-movie feel in this scene, which I was kind of hard to say why. You know, the script was good.
Mm-hmm.
The acting was good.
Yeah.
But there was just a veneer of, I don't know what it was, something along. But I like the scene where she gets caught doing the ritual, because I thought, in a weird way, it was relatable. You know, it's like, how embarrassing is that? You know? You go out in the woods to do your thing that's just private for you, and this hydrologist wanders in. And she had this pin in the back of her hair that was like this triangle. There are a lot of repeating shapes in this movie.
Yeah.
They probably have some kind of mystical significance. I know Stanley's into that sort of thing. I dug that later she had the Walden Books Necronomicon in her room. They showed it a few times.
Walden Books. Yes. Teresa, the mother, is working remotely as a financial advisor, but losing clients due to her illness.
Or maybe losing them because her home office is in a creepy attic.
Could be.
I mean, that didn't make any sense to me. There's a nice window. I thought, well, maybe it's because there's a nice window in the attic, but even that had a giant spider web on it. Yeah. So it hasn't been opened. If she's ill and working from home, why is she up there? They have a beautiful house with all these big open tables, and then she's up in the creepy attic. She's kind of stockbroker or something.
So Nathan is growing tomatoes and has alpacas for milk, which is not something I thought people raised alpacas for. Usually it's for their very soft wool, because they're big here in Yorkshire, because West Yorkshire has always been a wool industry, because there's lots of sheep and everything around here. And so they brought in alpacas at the end of the 19th century to use them for the wool, because it was really nice wool. There's even an alpaca in Transreality.
Here goes Moneybags Lackey again, shilling for big alpaca. I'm telling you, alpacas are good for anything. Rub an alpaca on your broken leg and you'll win $1 million.
That's not just like me. Nathan and Teresa are having a hard time with sex and intimacy after her mastectomy. Lavinia hates being out in the boonies. Benny is hanging out with a crazy old hippie, Tommy Chong, out in the woods. And Jack is withdrawn and just hangs out with the dog, Sam. Good setup. We have characters with issues and hopes. And now we know the storyteller is going to mess with them.
Tommy Chong gives a legit great performance in this movie, I thought.
Yeah. Really, it's good. Very short. He's not in there very long, but when he's in there, it's good. So the night Nathan and Teresa finally seem like they're going to have sex again, a meteor crashes into their front yard. It emits a weird color and a terrible smell that only Nathan seems to be able to detect.
Why that timing with they were about to have sex and the meteor hit?
I think it was going to be a good thing that was going to happen to them, and we can't have any good things happen to them.
They were the perfect family.
Well, that's what I like about this, is that they weren't. Like, they already had problems before this happened, and then it just gets worse.
Yeah.
Which I think thematically is very interesting and different than most movies. So the next morning, the meteor is cool and crumbling to dust. Ward, the surveyor, and the mayor come to check it out. Ward is concerned about it causing problems at the water table, but the mayor isn't.
There's apparently a festival celebrating black and white photography coming to town, and the mayor doesn't want to hear about any damn color coming to ruin everything.
Oh, yeah.
That's not in there. Should have been.
That night, the meteor is struck by lightning a bunch, staying close to the original story, so I'm very impressed with this. Ward looks at his water samples after the meteor has landed there and sees that it's all weird, and he tells the gardeners not to drink the water, but the mayor wants it under wraps for fear of scaring away developers. The little kid Jack becomes obsessed with the well, and he just stares at it all day. Strange vegetation starts growing, as well as weird-looking bugs. Jack says that there is a man that lives in the well.
The bugs looked pretty neat, I thought.
Yeah.
That is a legit note we would have gotten from an executive, though, if we'd have pitched Color Out of Space. They probably would have said, you should have a black and white photography festival going on. Who fears color more than black and white?
Everyone seems to be a bit off at this point, and one of the jarring things about this movie is Nick Cage's uneven performance. I don't know how you felt about it. He's crazy, but it's just too much or the wrong way. Like, one of his rants seems like he's doing a Donald Trump impersonation.
Yeah, it did.
But when he stops, it's easy enough to get back into the movie. But I had to say that his bits that he did took me out of it.
I think, like you say, the family already had problems in the beginning, a little like The Shining. I feel like he was really going for Jack Nicholson's Shining sort of thing. Because in The Shining, Jack's kind of kooky pretty early in the movie. But this one, I do think it would have been served with a slower burn in terms of the insanity. I mean, everybody's affected by this thing right away. And it did provide some levity. But yeah, it stuck up for me too. I was pretty sure that Richard Stanley hadn't put together a rap retelling of the story for the end credits, though, like I would hope. So Nicolas Cage's little goofy impressions kind of provided the levity that normally a rap would
Yeah,
it would. Inject. Yeah.
Yeah, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Ghostbusters 2.
Or Dragnet, yeah.
I don't know why that doesn't happen in movies anymore.
Well, a movie like this especially, it's so depressing.
Yeah. A news crew shows up to ask about the meteor, and Nathan comes off looking like a drunk, crazy man.
That was a very funny scene. Yeah.
Teresa is getting more and more insane, and while she's making dinner, she cuts off her fingers. Nathan has to then rush her to the hospital.
Doesn't seem to notice that she chopped them off either. Like I say, it's affecting everybody right away. And if you're into body horror, you're going to really like this movie.
So Benny's in charge. He's having gaps of time missing. So like things just cut out and he's standing in a different place and he's like, doesn't know how he got there. And Lavinia is having these problems as well. Jack runs off with a dog after something that they saw in the well.
And he and the dog get married, which is kind of a cool C plot. Nathan comes home and he freaks out on them. He showers the next day and there's some squid-like thing in the drain, which was really cool.
Yeah.
And disgusting. He tries the fruit. It's all bad.
So the next night, Jack and Benny hear screaming in the barn and they decide to investigate. They discover something horrible has happened to the alpacas, but as the viewers, we don't get to see what it is. Teresa and Nathan run out and then some bolts of color come out of the barn and they fuse Teresa and Jack together into some strange monstrosity that is still living. And this, for me, was really hard to watch.
Yeah.
It was like really uncomfortable. I was watching with friends. We had people over. Oh, France Lee, who has read for our show. She came over and watched it because we had to rent it. And so we figured since we're renting, we might as well have other people come over and watch it. This is before.
Sharing the misery.
The virus. The sadness and the helplessness of the whole situation really hit home with me.
Yeah, it was horrible. And it was truly good horror. But talk about changing over 10 years. I don't know if I could deal with that stuff as much anymore.
Yeah.
Because they were, it was the sound. They were wailing and wailing and wailing forever. And man, it was just not a pleasant experience intentionally. It shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
But part of me just wanted to shut it off because it was making me so upset. You know, maybe if in the soundtrack it was like, and then little Jack got a bolt of bad weather and he and his mother got fused together. What? Fused to your mother. If it had been like that.
Yeah, I'm liking it already. Well done, Pfeiffer. They take the merged Jack and Teresa into the house. They're alive, but they're totally out of their mind. Like you said, they're just making noises. They're not even talking. They don't seem conscious, really. We have no idea how cognitive they are, if they're even really there anymore. They're going to try and take her to the hospital, but the car won't start. All the electronics aren't working. Obviously, the color's interfering with the technology. So they decide to take Teresa and Jack into the attic. Nathan flips out, he gets his shotgun, and he goes into the barn and he just blasts the alpaca mass. We get to see it. It's just all the alpacas are kind of fused together in this very monstrous creature.
It's a very thing kind of situation.
Yes. Yeah. Then he comes back into the house with the intent of putting Teresa, Jack out of their misery, and he points the gun at her, but of course he can't go through with it. Lavinia, off the deep end, starts cutting herself as part of some Wiccan spell to try and save her family.
Yeah, that seemed kind of unnecessary, but
yeah, I think
body horror, you know, you gotta see her slice up her arms and stuff.
So Benny hears the dog in the well, or he thinks he does, so he goes down to try and save it, but he's consumed by the color. That's the last straw, and Lavinia seems hopelessly insane at this point. Nathan, also mad, locks her in the attic with the mother-son creature, which has become aggressive. So it's like coming at her and stuff. Ward and the sheriff show up and they hear Lavinia's screams. They don't know what's going on, but they bust in, see the mother boy monster. But Nathan finally kills it with a shotgun blast. They try to take Lavinia away, but she won't go, saying the color won't allow any of them to leave. So the sheriff and Ward go off to see if Ezra, Tommy Chong, is still out there, but they only find his dried corpse. A tape recording playing of him talking about the color remaking the earth into something it knows. Color shoots out of the body, and the sheriff and Ward run off. A tree grabs and engulfs the sheriff, killing him.
That was a good laugh, at least.
What? What?
I mean, the tree just did it in kind of a hilarious way.
Was it?
It's funny to me.
So Ward goes back to the house to attempt to save Lavinia, but the colors shoots out of the well and goes up into space. Lavinia touches him and gives him a cryptic vision of where the color comes from.
Yeah, what did you think of that? Little glimpses of what this might be.
I was okay with it because it was so weird and strange. It didn't really tell me anything more.
Sure. And for all you know, this is just a hallucination that had nothing to do with anything. So yeah, I thought it was cool.
I thought it was cool. It gave it more of an epic scale, but it still didn't explain anything.
Yeah. It was just enough of a suggestion that, you know, I think it's a good setup for the flavor out of space. And, you know, kind of kicking off this whole universe.
Yeah, it's not quite sour, but it's not sweet.
It's not even umami. What is this?
At that point, Lavinia turns to dust. Ward runs into the house for safety. I don't know what he's thinking. Time seems to be twisting around and he sees visions of the whole family. We don't know if they're real or if they're visions, but there's a version of Nathan that's trying to kill him. He escapes into the wine cellar and then the color vanishes into the sky, tearing down the house. He awakens covered in ash. The whole farm is gray and ashy. There's no color anywhere. It is now the blasted heath. Ward is the only one with any color or life in him in this whole scene. Again, visually, very impressive.
Yeah.
We have a little epilogue where a grizzled Ward stands on the finished dam saying in a voiceover, knowing what he knows, he's never going to drink the water from here, and that maybe the color will return.
Yeah, Ward opens and closes the movie with narration, and in general, it's actual passages from the story. And I thought it was interesting in the podcast episodes, we kicked off the whole thing with this spaceship starting up kind of sound effect, and the movie did the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
And then both break into opening narration. I think we have the edge on that one. Right away, I was like, this movie would be so much better if I was hearing Lehman.
True. I agree.
Also, a word about sound design. Stop being mean to people with tinnitus. There are other ways to produce discomfort other than piercing high sounds.
Yeah.
This movie had them all over the place. And a lot of movies do this now. I think it's all Saving Private Ryan influenced,
right,
know, to show the impact of something. I'm going to play this really high note, but sometimes I hear it for the rest of the movie and then I can't enjoy it anymore. And I'm not just talking for my benefit. There are werewolves in the audience who are probably throwing up.
Sure.
When they hear these frequencies.
Of course. So this movie, like the story, is hard to watch and hard to digest. It's just so very, very sad. And to me, The Color Out of Space is a perfect piece of cosmic horror. The color is beyond our understanding, and we are powerless to stop it. The story is about the ultimate fact that we are all going to die eventually. And when we do, we're not going to be able to stop that. But not just that. Everyone we know will die. Our parents, our siblings, our children, even our society and our culture will die out eventually. And we won't ever ultimately understand why. You can see things happen, but like, why do things have to end? Why do things have to die? What's the point? There's no answers. I mean, we can come up with some stuff, but there's no objective answer to why everything happens the way it happens. It just does.
Who's gonna die? Everyone you know. That's our rap in the end of the show. What?
Yeah.
Thanks so much for tuning in, folks, and thanks for listening all these years. And thanks to Andrew Lehman from the past. That was Andrew Lehman time traveling up to this episode to deliver some excellent readings. We're going to do another Lovecraft story next. What are we going to revisit?
The Dunwich Horror.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I am too. It's going to be hot. You know what else is hot? Thanking patrons. Something I like to do, and I want to do it right now. I'm going to start by thanking Patrick.
I want to thank Brian Knoll.
I would like to thank Kevin Morris.
Brett Zyka, thank you.
Banana Tom, thank you.
I want to thank Jake.
Friend of the show, Banana Tom. I want to thank Don Entwistle.
I'd like to thank Ninja Lemon 007.
Yes. John Biggs, thank you.
And I'd just like to thank Maddie. Thank you, Maddie.
Thanks, Maddie. That's all we've got for this week. We'll be back with more Lovecraft next week. Been a while since we've been able to say that. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.